This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton and adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And we are coming to you live from a couple of places on the internet. We are live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter. Maybe you're listening later on Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get podcasts. That is all good altogether now in the hood. Now, Pete, our third, is away at a business conference this week.
Business conference, which a lot of quotes around that. Very unclear what that means. And let's remember the last time he went to a big conference, he had a bag with full of knives and weed.
Yes.
So that could mean anything.
Which sounds like a joke, except it isn't.
Except it's real, because he and Alex went to a Philly Comic-Con. And
yeah, it was Philly Comic-Con, and he got stopped. No, first he was like, oh, I'm really nervous about going in through security. I was like, why are you nervous? He was like, because my bag is full of knives and weed. And I was like, what? You're joking, right? And it turns out, no, he wasn't, in fact, not joking.
So yeah. Who brings a gun to a knife fight? It's who brings knives to a comic fight.
Yes, exactly. Well, you're going to win, probably. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
That is too bad that he's not here. Don't worry about it, though. We're going to have a great show for you anyway. We have awesome guests on the show. Why don't we bring in our first one here? He is the co-creator of The Last Count of Monte Cristo. Ladies and gentlemen, Aize Jebba Everett. Hello. How are you?
Yeah.
Hello. What's up, guys?
Not much. Thank you for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. Now, we were supposed to have your artist, Tristan, on the show. Unfortunately, he, I think, has some connection issues and may not be able to make it. But I'm still excited to talk about this book anyway. The way it is described in the blurb, at least, and you tell me more, but an Afrofuturist take on The Count of Monte Cristo from the pages that I've seen and the stuff that I've read. It's awesome and a wild take on this classic story. What did I miss, and what was the inspiration behind this book?
Well, there is a section where there are guns and knives and a bag, and they're going, no, I'm joking.
No, it's perfect. We've covered it. We're living it.
Living the dream. No, I mean, I think you got it. You know, the inspiration was a guy named John Jennings, who's the editor-in-chief of Megascope Comics. He's an imprint of Abrams. And he came to me. We collaborated on another project called Box of Bones, which is sort of like a Tales from the Crypt meets Black History. And he was like, hey, man, I really want to do a Count of Monte Cristo, but in outer space. And I was like, outer space is boring as hell, dude. I'm not doing that.
Wow.
I'm like, it's just boring sometimes.
It's empty. There's nothing going on. You know?
What are you going to do there? But I'm like, but if you talk about like a post-climate change Earth, you know, like 300 years in the future or so, maybe that's interesting. Maybe we can talk about what the climate looks like, how people have adapted, how animals have adapted, and all that fun, weird stuff. And, you know, the tagline that I love is, you know, what's the role of revenge on a dying world? So that's kind of how we came together on it.
Well, also, so you touched on this a little bit, but talk about how, not to focus on the blurb, but like taking specifically an Afrofuturist take on the story, how does it change the context? How does it change the themes from the original text?
Here's the funny thing. Not much.
Okay.
you know, when you're doing, I was doing research on the Count, and there's this great book called The Black Count that came out that was all about Alexandre Dumas, the author's father. And it turns out this guy was black from the Caribbean, or half black from the Caribbean, black now, so that's it. And he was like a rival of Napoleon's. He like fought in all of his wars. He was like this celebrated general. And so, you know, and thinking about it, I was like, well, all I really want to do is take, you know, the original author's father, who was obviously the inspiration for The Count of Monte Cristo, The Three Musketeers, The Man in the Iron Mask, all these things. And I just kind of want to highlight the blackness, so to speak, and do it the way that Dumas did it, which is not really talk about it so much as show it. So this all takes place off of the east coast of Africa. And it's not like we're sitting there being like, yeah, this is not getting out on Black Beauty Street on Black Day and, you know, black clothing. It's not that, right? It's just like, you know, in my script, what I said was all characters need to be of African, Indian, or Asian origin in design.
Yeah.
And that was, wow. was kind of it.
Yeah. Well, given I know he isn't here, but since you brought up the design, let's talk about that. What does Tristan Roach bring to the project? What was your collaboration like?
Oh my God, have you seen the book? I mean, what did he bring to the project? Right?
Look at the colors alone, the design. Yeah. It's popping.
And that's all him, man. Like, that's all Tristan. Like, that little lapel thing that looks like two snakes around him. I mean, that's all him. The design of the Monte Cristo, which in this version is a ship, you know, with like solar sails, and it's like the future, which is behind him. Like, he designed that. He brought this amazing sort of, I call it like anime by way of the Caribbean sort of design, you know, like very bright, vibrant colors, lots of flowing and moving design, but very much manga influenced, and, you know, sort of that sort of Asian angle, but like when it comes to human bodies, pulling a lot more from traditional Caribbean culture and tradition. Yeah, I mean, the collaboration was freaking seamless. You know, I you know, tried to do my best to write they call it like Alan Moore scripts. You know, you write like 35 pages of script for one page of actual comic, and he just took it and ran with it. He was like, yep, how does this sound? How does this look? How does this sound? How does this? And like, you know, every 5 days we'd get this like dump of pages that were absolutely amazing. He's like, I'm still working on it. I'm like, stop working, dude. We've done it. This is perfect.
Yeah.
The original book, Count of Monte Cristo, is of like a very long revenge. It's like like a light. You're like, what do I want to spend my life on? A really great burn. So how does that play into, like you say, a world that is sort of coming to an end? How do you know when to pull the trigger on your revenge if you're like, uh-oh, we only got a couple of weeks left?
Well, I mean, you know, when plotting it out, you know, I was fortunate that I didn't have to say, okay, and this is when the world ends. But it is kind of, he's one of the few people, I mean, you can make that argument today that, like, the world is ending.
Fair.
Right? The world is ending until it ends. Right. And so it's this interesting dynamic of how are people getting by in their day to day? And this character has this knowledge of like, oh, yeah, we don't have too many more day to days. And so what's important at that moment? Right. Like, and I think initially, you know, if you've been imprisoned unjustly by people who you thought were your friends, you know, years ago, it's kind of like, no, I want to see you cry. I want to see your children cry. I want to see your children's dogs cry. Right. After you get one or two of those, you're kind of like, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, once you get the dogs.
You know, like, once the dogs are gone, what are you doing? You know, you gotta have a little limit. So I think Dumas in this one, he kind of realizes, like, hey, maybe it's time. Sorry, Dante. He kind of realizes it's time for the revenge to end. And at the same time he does that, one of those kids is like, oh, yeah, you're the one who screwed over my family, so now you gotta die. So then we have that final tension.
That's awesome.
I was curious to hear you talk about working with Abrams in particular, because I feel like, and maybe this is from our perspective of the show, but I feel like they don't get as much love necessarily from like the mainstream comic press, but they're sneakily one of the best publishers in the comic game. So what brings you to them? I assume it was partially that. And what's it like working with them?
You know, it was definitely Megascope. It was definitely John Jennings, like I said before. He started this imprint specifically about, you know, telling stories about people of color for people of color. And so I was like, you know, dope. And, you know, I'm like, I think I qualify. And it's just, I mean, like, I hate to sound like a hippie, but it's just been seamless. Like, it's just been, you know, folks who are loving the script. How often do you, as a writer, as a comic book writer, how often do you hear, like, the editor being like, I love this script. He's like, I wish we could publish this script. And I was like, oh, shit, right? Yeah. So that was awesome. And then, I mean, they've been really good with timelines. They've been really good with, like, working with us. There wasn't a lot of editorial, well, you should do it this way or that way. You know, it's mostly, like, hey, page count, you know, think about holdouts, think about, like, you know, two-page spreads. So just, like, walking us through the practicals, but they were very hands-off and very, very supportive. I don't, you know, have friends that have written for Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, Boom, all of them, and that is not the experience they have given to me. So I'm like, okay, you know, we'll see what happens when I write for somebody else.
Well, this book is great. It is available everywhere now from Abram Books, right?
Everywhere books are sold. Yep, right. Including your local bookstore.
Excellent. And anything else you want to plug before we let you go? Any other projects coming up for you?
There's also Box of Bones. Volume 1 is out now. Volume 2 will be out in October. Out by, God, I can't remember the press. Rosarium, sorry. Out by Rosarium Press. Like I said, Tales from the Crypt meets Black History. What happens when black blood is spilled on a box and demons are unleashed every time? How does that happen? How does that go throughout history? So yeah, it's a really fun book. And then I got other stuff coming, but mostly novels.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Congrats on the book. It is very cool, and I'm looking forward to everything else from you.
Awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, it looks great, man.
All right. I appreciate it, Justin.
Great to have you.
All right, there we go. Once again, the book is called The Last Count of Monte Cristo. You can get it from Abrams Books everywhere that fine books are sold. Definitely check it out. A little later in the show, we're going to have Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez is here, but we are going to bring in our second guest now. He's the writer of Voices from Krypton, the unofficial, unauthorized history of Superman. Ladies and gentlemen, Ed Gross, hello.
Hello, General. Hey, that's a nice book.
Yeah, look at that.
Nice cover.
It's a, wait, hold it, hold it sideways for anybody watching, because it's a thick book, too.
It is a thick book.
It covers my face.
My brother, being a wise ass, decided to put it. He's got the 69 Mustang and he decided to put it behind the rear tire. And he says, this will work better than the thing I've got there, you know, the blocker.
Congrats. That's a sale. That's a whole other market for
you're not kidding.
Yeah. So this book, this is an oral history of Superman, and you have a lot of amazing voices in there. You have a foreword from Brandon Routh and a afterword from Mark Waid, or did I switch those around?
No, that's correct.
That's correct. Yeah. Also, you talked to Tom Welling, a bunch of other people for the book. I think I could tell you're a Superman fan based on the life-size. There's literally a life-size Superman behind you with a Captain hat. There's an Action Comics on a spinner rack. You have a TV, which I assume is Superman themed as well. What spurred on this book, and what was the process like putting together something that has decades and decades of history?
So do I, actually, decades and decades of history. It's really, I think, a combination of my 40 plus years as an entertainment journalist and my almost, well, I'm over 60, but my almost 60 years as a Superman fan. Mm-hmm. And the two of them really dovetailed perfectly for this book. I mean, I've written other books, many other books, but this one is the one that is sort of the dream project for me. And in a sense, I've been writing it for 40 years because as soon as I got the opportunity to become an entertainment journalist, I started doing Superman-related interviews amongst all the other ones I did. Mm-hmm. So I've accumulated contacts with people, interviews with people, many people who aren't with us anymore, and was able to get all the new interviews, those interviews, pull it all together. And these oral histories are like doing a jigsaw puzzle, and that's really what this was. It's taking the 250 voices and looking at those transcripts and trying to sort of jumble the quotes around until it's telling a cohesive history that's covering 85, actually a little more than 85 years since before the character was created.
Yeah, just reading through the book, it really is like you jump around so much, and the organization of that must have been insane. Did you start with like chapters and you were like, oh, let me put this anecdote here. Oh, I want to hear from Jeff Loeb at this point. Like, how did that all come?
It's not really about I want to hear from Jeff at this point. What it really is, doing the interviews, and you start with one interview and you start taking the transcript and breaking it into subjects. So it's like, oh, he mentions this here. He mentions this here. He mentions this here. So you're building the categories, so to speak. I knew that it had to cover the whole history. So I knew that meant every phase of the comic, basically, and every version of Superman, whatever media he took it in. And you got to realize, since 1940 in the radio show, he's been in production in something every decade since, which is just insane.
Yeah.
How many versions? So then you take all those different interviews, and then as obviously as you get the second person saying, oh, well, that's what he said or talked about, let me put this quote here. And then the third person, oh, that goes there. And then you start jumbling it to make sure that it's the flow, that it's like a conversation, which is amazing. I can even do it because, frankly, I'm so disorganized in my life. I am an idiot savant when it comes to oral histories. I don't know why, but it's the one thing I look at and I can just start clicking the quotes together. And I wish I could do that with the rest of my life, but I can't. So, I'll accept this.
Not to go far afield for the book, we'll get back to it in a second, but I just want to ask before I forget, a couple of hours ago, they announced the casting for James Gunn's Superman Legacy movie. David Corenswet is going to be the new Superman. Rachel Brosnahan is going to be Lois Lane. Given that you're so steeped in this world, what's your take on that? What's your immediate feeling on this casting?
Well, first of all, it's very funny because I just went on YouTube and started checking out like fan trailers that were done a month or two ago with David as Superman. And some of them are really impressive. I mean, a couple of them really look great. And watching him and listening to his dialogue from other projects he's done, it sounds Superman-ish. You know what I mean? It sounds like I like the way he comes across. It doesn't hurt that the trailers had him in the Superman costume and stuff. So that's kind of cool. But there's a sincerity about him, it seems. I don't really know his work, but he just projects, this is a guy who cares. Mm-hmm. And that's what you need for Superman, I think. And as far as Rachel is concerned, she was great as Mrs. Maisel. I mean, I heard the concern about her and David is that she might be a little older than he is, so it may be an odd pairing. That's what they were saying. But as soon as I heard her and him, it seems like really great casting. I mean, usually they go for the unknowns, but she was, you know, she's known, but she's fantastic. So,
yeah, I'm psyched. I think it's fun. Just the fact that it's moving forward in this way is exciting.
And this is
feels
the thing.
Like great creative swing.
Yeah, and it does. And that's the thing. It's like my son wrote me and said, so what do you think of the casting and all this? My answer to him was this, and I've said this before, but it's true. I go where the S goes. If, you know, if Henry's done, and I thought Henry was a very good Superman, I wasn't always happy with the material he got, but I thought Henry Cavill was a very good Superman. And you suddenly say, well, now this is the new guy. I'm like, okay, bye, Henry. You know, got to move on to the next guy. It's like James Bond to me. It's like whoever they announce after Daniel Craig, I'm not going to take a wait and see attitude. I'm going to go see the James Bond movie. So
now, why do you think it's been so hard to really get Superman right? I feel like, you know, the Batman movies in the last like couple decades, say, or 30 years, like the Batman movies seem to keep progressing. They're different, but they seem to work. Superman, it always feels like we're missing a piece. What do you think that is?
I think the piece
the most read Superman person that we've talked to.
Well, thank you. Look, I liked Brandon Routh, for instance, as Superman in Superman Returns. I do think they tried to model that movie too much after the Donner films and all that, but his portrayal was, I thought, wonderful. And that was a step in the right direction, I thought, but, you know, besides the repetition of the old stuff. The problem I find is, and they seem to be correcting this now in the comics and everything, is there is this period where everybody just was fascinated on Superman's red eyes flaring, like he's about to burn you. Right. Mm-hmm. Or he's angry and he's angsty. I mean, that was the bad thing about Henry's portrayal, I thought, was every time he saved somebody, he looked like he was constipated. He hated using his powers. That was the impression I got. Right. And I think going for that dark Superman all the time is a mistake because that's not what the character is. Like Batman v Superman, I mean, Henry, unfortunately, but he is the one outside of Tyler on TV. But in the movies, Henry's sort of the representation for the last 10 years. So you put him in Batman v Superman, and when he's as sort of angst-ridden and dark as Batman is, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. The character needs, as corny and cliched as it is, the character needs to represent hope. It's like the moment of Brandon Routh in Crisis on Infinite Earths when they asked, you know, why do you have a black background to the S? And he says, because the black is the darkness and the red of the S is hope rising from it. Hmm. And this is a guy who lost everything in that world, right? But that's what's important to hold on to. And Tyler nails that, I think, and the writers nail that on Superman and Lois. Mm-hmm. They really nail that character and that hopefulness of the character. No matter how dire things are, he's not ready to go dark and break somebody's neck or whatever it may be.
I love the highlighting that Superman loves. There's a joy in him using his powers and saving people, and you know, I haven't heard it positioned that way, and that's really true. Even if there's a struggle and it even gets dark at points, just that essential joy of being Superman, I think, has been missing for so long.
And I agree with that. And I like Mark Waid and Jeff Loeb said two great quotes to me, which aren't new quotes, I'm sure. But Mark's thing was, here's a man who has the power to do anything he wants to do, and he chooses to do what's right. Jeff Loeb's comment was, if Superman has any angst at all, it's that he can't save more people. Mm-hmm. That's sort of, and I thought those two views of him were very interesting, you know? And I have a feeling, look, a lot of people are ready to jump on James Gunn and cut him up for, you know, carve him up for his previous projects or whatever. And he's wrong for Superman. He's wrong for DC and all that stuff. I will take a wait and see attitude, but I also believe that they recognize this character has got to be nailed properly in this movie, because otherwise there's not going to be a Superman movie again for a very long time.
Well, and they're pinning the whole future on this movie.
Right. And that's the funny thing. Like, people always say, oh, he's such a hard character to relate to. He's a hard character to write or whatever it is. But every time they relaunch, they start with Superman.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
Think about it. Man of Steel launched it in animation. Superman Man of Tomorrow launched it. And that was the beginning story, right? In the comics, they're sort of like have gone back in some ways to early stuff. That is just so funny to me that a character that supposedly is so hard is the one they turn to say, we're starting over and we're starting with Superman.
It's also funny where it's like, you relate to Batman more? Rich guy, no parents, murderer all the time, lives in a cave. Oh, you okay? Yeah.
We are in dark times. I will say that.
Fights a clown. The two quick things that I want to say about that, just there's a discussion about Superman going into the public domain here. This is not exactly that, but part of the reason we did a Man of Steel rewatch podcast, part of the reason they did Man of Steel, which I'm sure you know, Ed, but I don't know if our podcast listeners do, is they were essentially contractually obligated to, like if they didn't do it by, I think it was 2013, is that right? Something like
that. I have to be honest with you. I have not heard that. I mean, the point, and that doesn't mean that's not true. I just didn't hear it. Yeah. But the point is, as I said earlier, I don't think it's contractual that they have kept Superman in production for all these years. As far as 2013, I know that was a period where there's a lot of lawsuits and stuff going back and forth between the estate of Jerry Siegel and all. Mm-hmm. And we do get now, instead of just, I always like the smoothness of created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Now we have to get Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster by special arrangement with the Jerry Siegel estate. I mean, it's like, so I'm not sure what that is, right? It's a lot cooler when it was just created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
But. Yeah. The other thing that I'll throw out there, which I thought was an interesting detail, and again, we can get back to the book, but just while we're talking about the James Gunn thing, and on the same note, there was a thing, not in the article announcing the casting, but the one when they were talking about here's sort of the final rundown of the casting that they mentioned, that apparently in James Gunn's Superman movie, Superman is not the first superhero in the world. The Authority is actually there first and being active. And at first I was like, well, that's weird because that's not how it happens literally any other time. But the more that I thought about it, my guess here is that you essentially have a dark superhero team that's extreme in the
and
world.
Superman is the answer. The answer.
Exactly.
The counterpoint. It's perfect.
It's actually a great idea.
So I can't wait for that. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, and something that hasn't been attempted before, to have Superman be a counterpoint to something. To your point, Ed, like, it's always like, let's start with Superman, where it's like, he has to be first, and everyone's like, what is this? Yeah. And we're all past that as moviegoers and comic fans for sure. Right. So it's like, yes, let's have him be the response to a darker world, like we're talking about we live in sort of now.
And so, let's put the John Williams theme as to Superman as the James Bond theme is to James Bond, please. Even if you switch it around, get that theme in there, because it gets people revved up for this character, I think.
Yeah. I got a little bit of a gimme here about the book, because I know the answer is yes, but Derek Mainhart asked, do you cover the never filmed Nick Cage version in the book?
Yes.
Great.
I had a lot of help from on that section with Holly Payne, who did the, you know, produced The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, that wonderful documentary on that. And I did my own interviews with Kevin Smith. I had done an interview with Nicolas Cage some time ago. And Holly gave me permission to use anything I wanted from the documentary.
Oh, wow.
So between that's my awesome stuff and her stuff, I think the chapter was really able to tell the story of the movie that never happened. And even got Jonathan Lemkin, one of the early writers on the project. And my goal in writing this book, and includes the Superman Lives thing, is to make sure not only was everything represented, but that in a sense, there were a series of books in this one book. Like the George Reeves show gets 25,000 words. The Christopher Reeve movies get 30,000 words. Smallville gets this many words. You know what I mean? The idea was to make sure that everything is fully represented and not just a paragraph saying, well, there was this thing, even that terrible 1975 production of It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman gets interviews with David Wilson and Leslie Ann Warren. I mean, talking about that not great production, but
well, that kind of leads nicely into the next thing that I was going to ask you, which as we've been talking about over the course of this conversation, Superman obviously is an ongoing thing. Like, they have a TV show that's just doing its finale tonight, I think, and then there's Superman Legacy season finale. Yeah, and Superman Legacy is coming out. There's comics coming out all the time, so. How do you decide where to end it? Is it just the published date? Are you going to revisit it with a volume 2 at some point? What's your thought process?
To be continued.
Though? Well, I mentioned to the publisher, I said, you know what? Superman Legacy is coming out in 2025. We should think about a volume 2 of this. And the response I got initially was, it's almost 800 pages long. How much longer can we make it? And I was like, no. I'm saying a separate volume. Because there could be a history of Lois Lane and Lex Luthor and Supergirl and Superboy and the new movie and my Adventures with Superman TV show. It's ongoing. So, yeah, can there be a volume 2? Do I want to write a volume 2? Yes. It was so funny because, you know, I finished a lot of these books, like on Star Trek and Star Wars and James Bond and all these things, and I'm ready to move on. I mean, my love for it doesn't go away, but I'm kind of done with that subject, you know, whatever it may be. When I finished, I mentioned to some friends that I finished Voices from Krypton. Their response was, you must never want to hear the name Superman again. And my response was, no, I put on the John Williams theme the second I handed in the book, and I just blasted in, and I'm ready to go. I mean, for some reason, like, I just love the character and can write about him forever. There's so much to write about still.
Awesome.
That makes sense. Though I'm curious if when you're talking about a Star Trek book, do you have like a Jean-Luc Picard that you slide in behind you? And
No. This is, we read in our house. You know what it is? My wife always buys me for birthday, Christmas, Father's Day, whatever it may be. And everybody does. They buy me stuff with Superman on it, the S on it, or whatever it may be. I never buy this stuff, but people give it to me. So when we redid our house, my wife said to me, she goes, you know what? She's not into this stuff at all, but she said to me, and this is a keeper, right? She says, why don't we take our small living room and turn it into a Superman room for you?
Oh. Wow.
So we got the statue and the comic rack, and there's a bunch of action figures, the things, the statues and things that everybody buys me. And the book is over there, of course.
Amazing.
Awesome. Yeah, it's great. So.
Well, real quick, I forgot to do this at the beginning, but I wanted to let you know we have a professional chef, Brett Macris, aka Straight Bullet, who usually curates a cocktail for us each show. Sometimes he designs a cocktail, and this week he designed the cocktail around your book and Superman in general, but it is a cocktail from Krypton, which he designed. It's dark rum, ancho raise, which is a spicy liqueur, Campari, orange liqueur, lime juice, and mint leaves, and it's supposed to evoke Krypton with the green, I guess, and then also just exploding flavors in your mouth, because that's what happens to crypto as well.
So yeah, and little rockets shoot out of your mouth with babies in them. It's really weird.
Sea rockets.
Yes. Well, it's a very good one, very delicious. I have one quick audience question here that I'm going to throw out to you before we finish. This is maybe too hard. Do you have a favorite version of Superman?
I mean, yeah, the cliche, of course, is going to be Christopher Reeve, right? If there is, when I see Christopher Reeve as Superman, there are two moments that stand out for me: the helicopter rescue in Superman the movie, and but really my favorite Superman too, when Lois is under the elevator in Paris and it's plummeting, and he catches it, and her head snaps up. He looks at her and just goes, "I believe this is your floor," and he smiles at her. I love it. Right now, that being said, like I said earlier, I go with yes. So it's like, yes, Christopher Reeve is my favorite. But the thing I enjoy, and after I saw the clip of David as Superman today, you know, the fan clip, all I thought was, I cannot wait till somebody takes the John Williams theme, intercuts again all the different versions of Superman from over the years, like they've done in many tributes, and he now will become part of that. And I'm actually pretty psyched for it. I mean, I love that because, again, it's this ongoing history that probably will never stop unless they blow it with the movie. Let's hope not.
So, great.
So awesome. Ed, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for chatting. You can check out the book at this point. It's out on stands. You can get it anywhere, right?
Love that book.
Yeah. It's a good summer read.
Yes. And winter, too. It might carry it over to winter.
Are you working on another one? Not necessarily another volume, but do you have any upcoming projects?
There's an Indiana Jones book coming out. That's the next oral history in Indiana Jones. And I'm literally like a month away from wrapping up Planet of the Apes, which I'm very psyched for. I had done a book back in 2001 called Planet of the Apes Revisited. And since then, there have been so many Planet of the Apes books, we wanted to figure something different to do. So we're turning it into an oral history, and of course, expanding beyond the original films to include Burton, the new trilogy, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, the whole thing. So I'm pretty psyched about that. So
awesome.
Yeah, I'm moving from one to the next to the next.
You're just living it.
Yeah, well,
amazing.
Somebody's got to do it. might as well be me.
Excellent, Ed. Thank you so much for coming on. Pleasure chatting.
Thank you, guys.
Congratulations. Yeah, thank
you. Appreciate it.
Great book
for having me.
Thanks, Ed. You bet.
All right, there we go. Once again, that was Ed Gross. It's Voices from Krypton, the unofficial, unauthorized history of Superman. And as we said, you can get it from bookstores everywhere right now, so definitely check it out. Why don't we bring in our third guest here? He has a zoo project that is killing it right now. Ladies and gentlemen, Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez, hello.
What's going on? What's going on?
Hey.
Welcome. Wow. Thank you for hanging out. Thank you for chatting. I love the background. You got your comic right behind you. I'm going to mangle the name. I'm sorry, but La Borracena, is that?
That's good, man. That's
okay.
Good. I mean, if we are like, you know, nerds that can learn Klingon or throw Elvish, you know what I mean? I think we can learn some Spanish.
I think so,
too. 100%.
Thanks for having me on. And yeah, yo, that cocktail, come on, y'all, come on. Red Sun, Kryptonite.
Red Sun, no.
I know, I missed it. I'm sorry.
And look at the logo, the Kirby crackling Red Sun in the background. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Come on, you guys just lost a lot of points.
I'm not familiar with the Superman character that much, so there we go. This book is great. It is coming back, I guess is the best way to put it, or this is a new volume, new printing, new edition of the comic, new collection. How would you describe it? Because again, here a little bit.
If we're, I guess, into the thousands of pages, which it isn't, it would possibly be an omnibus, but this is going to be our first collected edition. So it's volume one. And what it's doing is putting together the first four full-length graphic novels that I've published, which are issued 1 through 3, including the fourth book, which is a team-up graphic novel with Rosario Dawson. And these books have been published under my studio, Somosalte, over the last 7 years. And we've had the opportunity of having these books taught at Princeton, MIT, Penn State, my alma mater of Colgate University, across the United States and in Puerto Rico. And it's an opportunity for schools, libraries, or even just collectors to have all of the graphic novels in one hardcover edition. Oftentimes, when our books are distributed to public schools across the U.S., for example, we get a lot of support from the Penn Faulkner Foundation in Washington, D.C. These graphic novels get into the hands of children, and you know, they're paperbacks. So they don't have that much durability. That's why children's books are made in hardcover. So the idea for this is it's the library edition, right? It's perfectly on a library shelf and for school, local library, university, museum. There's a museum that has the first issue of La Borinqueña in its permanent collection, which is the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. And a museum that's going to be opening in the near future, Lucas Museum. They actually purchased a collection of all hardcovers for their library. And they also have original art that they purchased from our collection, which is also going to be part of their permanent collection as well. So, you know, for like a very small imprint like ours to have the opportunity to find ourselves in so many institutions beyond, you know, fandom, I think it's a great chance to finally be able to put this into a hardcover edition. And, you know, working with the fellas at Zoop, Jordan and Eric, you know, they've created an incredible model that really supports independent artists and storytellers like myself. You know, oftentimes we are a one-man band. We do full order fulfillment, marketing, publicity, events, packaging, print production. And with Zoop, you know, they're actually doing a lot of that for us. So one of the main reasons why we didn't decide to do this 100% independently was the logistics. Where the heck are we going to put a whole bunch of hardcover books? It's real. And these are also oversized. They're going to be like 9x12, which is like way larger than a typical comic book. So it's exciting. It really is exciting to have this. And, you know, we are very fortunate that cover artist Ariel Jesus Colon, who just made his debut with DC Comics last fall, he donated the art for this this collection. So it's going to be never before seen art. And we also have a collection of like over 50 pinup illustrations where all of these different artists have interpreted La Borinqueña, from Bill Sienkiewicz to Carlos Pacheco. So there are so many artists in the industry that I look up to that have been working with us through this project. So it's exciting to finally have it. You know, I'm in my office where I'm literally surrounded by bookshelves.
Yeah, you're in the book right now.
Yeah, so it's like it's great to actually have like bookshelf space for my hardcover, and I'm gonna, you know, I can see it going right next to the New Frontier slipcase edition that I have that Darwin Cook with the illustrator and writer for, you know. So it's an exciting project.
It's big,
And one of the things that we're really excited about is that this is going to continue to support our philanthropic work, which really started when we did this first team up book with DC Comics. And talking about, you know, Superman, you know, he was actually featured in this book. It was written by Greg Pak. It was illustrated by Ken Lawson. Awesome. And this was an interesting conversation because while we were working on this book, DC had it feels like he was pantless when he didn't have the red shirt, right? And they were, you know, behind the scenes, there was buzz that, you know, Superman was going to go back to his red trunk. So I was like, put him back in his red trunks for this book, you know? And I was kind of like, you know, going back and forth about that. And I was like, look, I'm going to put out this book right around the time when you guys officially announced that he's back in his red trunks. So they gave me permission to put him in his red trunks for this book. And so, yeah, so it's an interesting space. And also I enjoyed listening to your show because I'm like, I can see so many like similar points, particularly with your previous guest, Ed Gross, because Superman was a big influence in me creating La Borinqueña, from the costume to the character. Mm-hmm.
Can you take it back and tell us about La Borinqueña, her origin, like how the story works,
so story was really inspired by socioeconomic issues affecting Puerto Rico, which is a U.S. colony that has been now for the last century, and there are 3 million Puerto Ricanos living in the archipelago with U.S. citizenship, and 6 million, including myself, across the United States. But so even my great grandparents who were born there were born U.S. citizens and have served in the military since before World War One. Right. The character herself is a college student who visits Puerto Rico because she wants to study abroad and also be there to take care of her grandparents, who are retired. But as typical senior citizens and grandparents, they're very, very busy running a restaurant now. So she goes to Puerto Rico to kind of like take a semester abroad. But while she's there, she's faced with the realities of an island that's in a calamity because of this failing economy, because of the reality of climate change. And I pull all of these real world themes into the book, but also connect it to the mythology of Puerto Rico. And obviously, in the same space of talking about Superman, we know that Superman is the archetype that's inspired by Moses, by the Old Testament, and how so many other superheroes draw their inspiration from mythology. That's what I did also with La Borinqueña. Puerto Rico has its own indigenous people, the Taínos, who have their own mythologies. They believe in a mother goddess that was connected to the elements. So therefore, she imbues this character that I created with superhuman, supernatural abilities to control the elements. By controlling the winds, she can fly. Her superhuman strength comes from one of the other deities of Yukahu, who is the god of the seas and the mountains. And so she has superhuman strength, which allows her to save the day, which allows her to finally start to recognize that these powers are going to help deal with what is a real issue affecting people even today. I mean, oftentimes these are tropes that find themselves in comics, you know, evil corporations taking over, evil experimentation, creating, you know, mutants. And that's a real thing that's connected to Puerto Rico's history. A lot of people may not know that, like, a lot of cancer research was experimented on Puerto Rican men. A lot of Puerto Rican women were sterilized so that birth control pills could be created. So I take these tropes and apply them, and supernatural villains and superhuman villains come out of the stories. We may have been familiar with urban legends like the Chupacabra, that actually is originally from Puerto Rico. So a lot of those kind of like ideas of folk tales or urban legends work with this story. So it's classic superhero storytelling with a superhero who has these superhuman powers. And this graphic novel is putting together, rather this is some hardcover edition, it's putting together 7 years of storytelling. So it's four graphic novels, is a full complete story arc. The origin story, the introduction of her team of superheroes that she actually leads, and her first major confrontation with a supervillain and the kind of like the big enemy of the larger story. And kind of like it also continues and kind of comes together with the final story, which actually brings Rosario Dawson as herself. It's kind of like some Scooby-Doo mystery, right? With a celebrity. It's in the book as herself. You know, and there's even a couple of Ahsoka Tano jokes in the comic book, because being her friend,
that's hilarious.
Ahsoka Tano, like years before it was even announced, so I knew the book was going to come out later. So I was like, oh, I could drop in some.
I could drop. Wow, here, that's. You
know? Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you actually about the celebrity thing, because obviously you have Rosario Dawson here. It sounds like you guys are friends. You've also worked with DMC. You worked with John Leguizamo. As comic book fans, I think sometimes we see a book that has a celebrity attached. We're like, all right, prove it to us. So what's the trick there then? What's the trick when you bring in a celebrity? Is it that you already know that they have an affinity towards the comic book material? Is it coaching them in some way? What's your technique?
A bit of both. You know, I've been fortunate that in the case of John Leguizamo and Daryl McDaniels, DMC, they both were comic book fans. Right. Yeah. John comes from it from a different perspective because he's been very outspoken as an advocate for Latino rights and representation, and has been doing an incredibly brilliant job from Hollywood Reporter to Washington Post, and even has a series now on MSNBC that was just renewed for a second season. But genuinely, he and Darryl, they're both nerds. They're both comic book geeks.
Yeah.
So the viability of comic book storytelling. I think that's the real way to look at it, right? They didn't look at it as, oh, let's make a comic book so that we can fast track this into a TV or film. It was more like, let me make a comic book because that's way cheaper to do than a movie or an animated series. And also there's no budget that's gonna limit the special effects. You know, the same pay rate that you give your artist, whether there's a a major city explosion or someone sitting on their sofa eating a sandwich. It's the same production budget, you know what I mean? So, and then, like, you know, Darryl, more than like John, was a huge comic book fan. For Darryl, he's,
we've interviewed him, and he is like a crazy comic book guy.
Yeah, I mean, like, the thing is, like, if you listen, if you do a deep dive into his Run DMC songs, it was there all the time. Mm-hmm. It was there all the time. There's a famous Rolling Stone article that was published when they were at the height of their stardom, cover story. And when you read through that article, the journalist is literally like commenting how like Darryl is in his own world on the side of the backstage reading comics. And this was Darryl at 18, 19 years old when he's about to go on stage in front of hundreds of thousands of people. And what is he doing? He's reading comic books. And that's like, that was his reality. And for these guys, like, John came in with really solid ideas. For Darryl, it was a lot more fun because I was able to create a universe for him. I was able to create a universe, and I did kind of like this kind of multiversal version of him. Like, what if he never became an MC, and what if in this universe he actually became a superhero? So it took place in the 80s, and we were the first comic book to actually bring in real graffiti artists to actually draw in the actual comic book pages. And the New York Times had reported about that because no one before then. Since then, some there have been now some collaborations, but we were the first ones to do that. And that was just 10 years ago, you know? I mean, given that hip-hop has been around now for 50 years, it took 40 years before hip-hop got into an actual legitimate comic book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We got a question here from the comments. I think I know the answer to this one, but Derek Maynard says, where does La Born Kenya stand on U.S. statehood?
That's a very good question. I personally don't have an answer that many people may expect. Because since I live here in the United States, I don't live in Puerto Rico and I don't pay taxes in Puerto Rico. And I think personally, the mere fact that I make an answer to that is very kind of like colonial in a way. So my idea is that I think that I like what Congresswomen Nydia Velazquez and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are doing. They're trying to pass legislation so that Puerto Ricans can actually tell us.
Can choose. Yeah.
Yes. I think they totally have the they don't have the authority, but they should have the authority, the right to tell us what they want. And I think what I do with my platform is I try to create an audience, a conversation to engage people. I do a lot of work in Puerto Rico. I support a lot of nonprofits with our grants programs. We've raised and awarded close to $200,000 in micro grants. And a lot of the work that we do is invested in giving a voice. And more than anything, giving a voice so that, good example, it was a CNN did a travel story and they interviewed me. In this article, I actually name dropped and referred them to organizations that were connected to, because I wanted to give them an opportunity to have a voice so that they could talk about their Puerto Rican experience. I live in Brooklyn. You know, my experience and my storytelling, it's still, even though it's inspired by reality, it's still steeped in fantasy. You know, I try to tell people, like, you got to remember that the main character in the story wears a cape and flies. You may be inspired by reality, but it's still a superhero comic book. And I think sometimes people get a little over invested, which is beautiful, because oftentimes comic books take us to completely fictional places like Wakanda or Metropolis, you know?
Yeah. Well, and what I love about this book is it's rooted in like real great superhero storytelling. The volume one, like the first story, like it's like invincible. The art is so good. Superman elements. There's elements of like in the origin, like remind me of Darkhawk, some of those old 90s stuff like mixed in there. Like it's a great soup, but also there's just so much Puerto Rican culture here. It's like baked into it in a way that I think is just a great, not a lot of comics can fuse those real life details with just great comic book storytelling.
Thank you. And I grew up as a fan. You know, I recently had the opportunity to have a great conversation with Chris Claremont, who's one of my heroes as a storyteller. And I still have my long boxes from the 70s and 80s when I was in elementary and middle school. And that's like my PhD. That is.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I think we all do, but I specifically can speak for myself that I love the era I grew up in with comic books, because comics didn't pander. Comics were for everybody. And I didn't realize that I thought when I was like 10 or 13 reading X-Men that they were for me. And then I would learn years later that there were people in their 30s and 40s and the 80s that were reading X-Men, you know, because we didn't have to have a rack just for the kiddies. You know what I mean? It's like that same X-Men that I read, somebody 20 or 30 years older than me was reading. So that's a lot of what I do with my books. And, you know, we have children in elementary schools reading La Borinqueña, and we have graduate students reading La Borinqueña. And that just blows me away that that model that I grew up in, I've been able to kind of emulate with my stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since the soup has been so successful, we haven't said the numbers here, but as of right now, you were looking for 15,000. You are up to almost 22,500 with 10 days left, which is awesome. Are you beyond this volume, which sounds great and people should definitely pick up? Are you looking to make more of it? Are you looking to expand the series? What is the plan?
Yeah. So what's next is one of the things that we started doing in the fourth book, which teams up La Borinqueña with Rosario Dawson, we introduced a whole team of superheroes, right? And we just did a spinoff of one of those characters. This character is called Oro El Coquirodado, which is the golden tree frog, right? This actually was created by my seven-year-old son, this character design. And then I took his character design and fully developed. It's gonna become an action figure line that's produced by a studio that'll be released in time for the holidays. Yeah. So the idea is we're gonna launch individual issues for the actual team members. So they don't get a graphic novel, but they get a standalone issue. And then the next book we're coming out is actually it's gonna be a spinoff of her best friend, Luz, who's an Asian Latina character that was introduced in the first book. By the third book, she becomes a superhero. So she's gonna have her own spinoff that's gonna be coming out in a couple of months. And the goal is that by the time the fourth issue come out, we'll have all of these like one-shots in between. So then La Borinqueña 4 will drop. And after La Borinqueña 4, then you'll have Oro number 2 and all these other like issue number 2s. And that's going to be what will in the future comprise of the second volume. So it's not only going to be the La Borinqueña stories, but it's going to be all of the spinoffs, because everything is still kind of like connected into one larger story arc. And we're also in pre-production for our fourth graphic novel that we're hoping to have for fall of 2024. And, you know, I'm a one-man band, just me and my wife.
Yeah. Son. Yeah. I was going to say, this is a lifestyle. This is just a book.
Well, and your seven-year-old son. He's in creative development. Right? I just want to say, don't forget.
Creative team.
Yeah, he is. We actually, just reminded me, he's supposed to give me a drawing that was supposed to include in this hardcover edition. Kind of like a behind-the-scenes sketch of the original character.
You tell him you are only as good as the deadlines that you hit, all right? Just tell him that.
Send him a strongly worded email because, you know, these creators are not paying.
They're out of control. They're out of control.
Sleep at the switch.
What is this, Gen Z? I don't know how many generations.
I'm not sure. Edgar, this is great. Thank you so much for coming on. This book is awesome. Congratulations on all the success, and I'm excited to read all of the spinoffs coming out.
Thank you so much, guys, and thank you for doing this show, keeping the culture alive and keeping it nerdy and keeping it geeky. I love it.
Oh, we do.
Always.
And same.
It's a great opportunity. And next time, guys, for real, it's a Red Sun cocktail that you've made.
No, I'm sorry.
It's gone now.
It's gone.
It's all over.
Next time we'll do a pina colada. That'll be way easier.
Exactly.
Yeah, we don't have to name it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Where's the La Borinqueña cocktail? We got to get
that. Next time. We'll do it next time. Absolutely.
There we go. Thank you, fellas. Thank you for having me on your show, man.
Take care. Have a good night. All right. There we go. Once again, it's La Borinqueña. You can check it out on Zoop now to pledge and get that great collected volume. It's very cool. The Last Kids on Earth and their superhero alter egos are back in the latest installment of the graphic novel spinoff series, The Last Comics on Earth, Too Many Villains. Jack, June, Quint, and Dirk face their biggest challenge yet, creating the sequel to their hit graphic novel in a mad dash, puzzle-filled race across Apocalyptia to stop the biggest evil plan in history. Hey, you know what the creators of Last Comics on Earth's evil plan is? Make me and my kids love these books. Seriously, my younger kid is a huge fan of both the Last Kids series and the Last Comic series.
It's true.
And now I'm hooked too. The whole team has created a delightful cast of characters with some fantastic kid-friendly art throughout that will appeal to readers of all ages. Buy your copy of The Last Comics on Earth in stores today. You can also visit lastkidsonearth.com to learn more.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
We are going to move on with our next section, which is my favorite section because you make it up. It is your audience questions. And for audience questions, all you got to do is drop a question in the comments on Facebook, YouTube, or Twitch. They can be about absolutely anything is fine.
It's a great time for a real Pete question that we can answer without him being here. You know what I mean?
Ooh, really throw him under the bus?
No, a question that we can actually tell the truth about without him yelling at us.
Yeah. Absolutely. So yeah, if you got questions about X-Men or Spider-Man marriages or anything like that, now's the show to do it.
Yeah.
What are you, you still drinking? You finished up?
No, I finished my Red Sun, moving on to, a Little Wolf, beer,
nice.
Very nice pale ale, from, this is a good brewery, Zero Gravity.
Oh, nice. Well, cool. I guess that's it for our audience questions then. We've covered pretty much everything. I did want to follow up. No, I did want to follow up. I know we talked about it briefly, but I guess this actually follows up on it. What I was going to talk about. Frederico Rosa says, which hero will Nicholas Holt finally get the part? So the question here, Nicholas Holt tried out for Batman. He didn't get it. Nicholas Holt was supposed to go in for Lex Luthor was the report. And then he was like, no, I want to try out for Superman. And he didn't get it. So poor guy, all he's got is all of these other projects he's doing and his incredible talent. But what superhero do you want Nicholas Holt as since he didn't get Batman or Superman?
I mean, I don't know. Haven't we cast everybody? Isn't that already sort of covered?
Well, the other thing is he could still be Batman. You know, like they haven't cast the Batman of the DCU yet.
That's fair. I mean, and let me throw out, like, he could be like a Scarecrow. He could be someone like that, I think makes a lot of sense.
Lex Luthor?
Nah, I don't know about Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
I think we need the young Lex Luthor thing. We got to get, he's got to be older, I think. Mm-hmm. Even if Superman's younger, Lex Luthor should be older, I think.
Well, they
he's
also
so conservative. He's hardened. He's anti-immigrant in the space, in the planetary way. I think he needs to be an older, like hardened person.
I will say one of my favorite comments I saw on Twitter was somebody saying that Nicholas Holt thinking he could be a better Superman than whoever eventually gets Superman is Lex Luthor 100%.
No, that's a great call. That he could be the real life Lex Luthor.
Exactly. I don't know. I was kind of thinking like it's probably wrong, but what a Green Lantern. Like I could see it was a Green Lantern kind of messing up, you know, but
I don't know. Honestly, the first thing I think of looking at a picture of him is he's Tobey Maguire from Spider-Man 3 when he's under the Venom influence.
Yeah.
So there you go. Sorry. Sorry, guy.
All right, we got a generic one here. Derek asks...
Generic?
No. I'm saying it's not specifically about, like, Superman movies or whatever. It's a general question. General question, not generic general. Question. Derek says, as the writer's strike drags on, and oh boy, is it dragging on, huh? What past shows do you recommend to binge?
Great question. This week I rewatched The Rocketeer. I tried to show make my kids watch it, and they were mm-hmm. like, we want to change this. I was like, no, we're watching this to the end. They were like, this is violent. I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of guns. But that's a great rewatch. I'm rewatching/watching Letterkenny on Hulu. Mm-hmm. But current shows, if you haven't watched The Bear yet, you got to watch The Bear.
Yeah, that's the thing about the past shows to recommend to binge. The writer's strike hasn't really affected much yet. We're going to see the effects probably... I don't know. Maybe not even the fall. The fall a little bit with the broadcast season.
You'll feel it in that there won't be your returning shows. But as far as new shows on streamers, I don't think you'll feel it until next year.
Yeah. This is from Stray Bullet. Don't tell Pete I asked this, but I think MJ Peter Parker is boring. What do you guys think?
I mean, let me throw out there. I know I'm alone in sort of liking this recent Zeb Wells story mm-hmm. where they're separated and she's with someone else and all that. But part of the reason I like it is that it's creating some space and tension between them when their relationship in the deep past was sort of like just very static and not super exciting. And then after all of the marriage breakup, it was sort of nothing in a weird empty way. So like, I like that there's some heat and something going on with them right now.
Yeah. This is from Kevin. What other comics characters would you like to see get oral histories? Justin, do you have an answer for that one?
My first thought is Captain America. I feel like sort of the Marvel Superman equivalent as a character that has a real long history that has less media, but I think more you could connect it to... larger politics and war and whatnot. And my say yours real quick is the Punisher is a sort of a darker answer.
Ooh, that would be cool. This is literally nothing against our guest, but I am generally more interested in micro oral histories that focus on like a very narrow, very specific thing and flesh it out with a big story about that thing.
You mean like that's called a conversation, I think.
Something like rather than being like we're talking about encompassing the entire history of this thing, more we're going to dive into a moment. I'll give you a very specific example. So One Tree Hill is a show that I've never watched in my life. I never watched it because I was like, what is this about? This is two brothers who play basketball. I don't know what's going on here. I don't care about this. And that's what I always thought the show was, even though people are like, no, it's a seminal teen show. You're going to love it. And I'm like, I do not have time to watch 7 seasons of the show about basketball boys. But somebody put up a clip being like, this is my favorite clip of all time from One Tree Hill. And I almost hesitate to spoil it, but just to kind of lay out what happens if you don't know what happens, it's in the 6th or 7th season. There's a guy who's supposed to get a heart transplant in the hospital, and this intern comes in carrying the heart that he's supposed to have the transplant, trips and falls in the lobby of the hospital.
Yes.
The heart slides out. A dog comes over, eats the heart, and runs away. And then it cuts to Chad Michael Murray staring at him and just like nodding as if he did it somehow. And then it cuts to the director credit immediately in the middle of Chad Michael Murray. And it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. There was, I don't remember who put it up, but somebody did an insanely extensive oral history just on that scene and the development of that scene where they talked to basically everybody involved, plus Mike Schur, the showrunner of Parks and Rec and The Good Place and a bunch of other things, because apparently that's something he talks about in every single writer's room. It's about like, what is our dog eating a heart from One Tree Hill? So they talk to him about that moment. And the funniest note in there is like, you get about several thousand words of the oral history, and there's an editor note that says, Chad Michael Murray declined to comment for this story, which, hilarious.
Says it all. That's your favorite comic book?
Yeah, I love that comic book, One Tree Hill, and now I've read all the issues. No, but my point is, like, I love deep dives into something like that. So just in terms of a character, like, penance is something where it's so specific, it's not long, but just the thought process that went into, we're going to turn Speedball into wearing an Iron Maiden on his body, what went into that with hindsight now, I think would be great.
That would be interesting because I feel like that was a series of weird decisions that sort of heightened and followed up on one another, where, because that was it, right when the New Warriors caused the explosion in Hartford, I believe, Connecticut, which led to civil war, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that he felt guilt about that because he was actually one of the only New Warriors that survived. So that guilt led him to need to punish himself, which led to the spikes on penance, and that changed his power set, and his powers messed up because of the explosion. Just like a series of disastrous choices, ruining one of the only like funny, goofy characters that was in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah. This one I actually don't know anything about, but I'm curious to hear if you do. This is from Stray Beans. Can you comment on Eric July claiming his saving the American comic industry by selling 40,000 copies of a first issue and 13,000 copies of a second issue of a generic superhero comic? I'm going to take away from this that probably he didn't, certainly based on that amount of sales. He definitely didn't, but I don't know who this is or what the circumstances are.
I don't know anything about this. I don't know what it is or what this is. But Eric July definitely tweeting about Comic-Con being in trouble since all of the TV has been sort of backing out is all I can see.
And Eric July is the brother of Eric August. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Good. I don't know anything about this. I'm sorry, Straight Beans. This is from Pablo D. Martinez. What do you think of the trailer for Five Nights at Freddy's that came out? I'll admit I watched the teaser trailer, which seemed fine. I did not watch the full trailer. Have you seen that, Justin?
I have also not.
Great. This is good. We're doing a good job. Let's see. Mike Spear Jr. says, what? Do you have an answer to that one?
Yes. But the answer is more.
Great. This is from Kevin. Did something fall in the basement?
Well, there's a lot happening, weirdly, in this current. My downstairs neighbors are throwing snaps, the little
oh, yeah.
things that pop out front here while they're moving chairs around upstairs. So, like, it's an annoying thing. I'll tell you that.
What if MJ got together with Michelangelo? Would Pete approve?
That might be a big, first off, the April O'Neil erasure is worrisome for Pete. Though yes. April O'Neil and MJ sort of, I don't know, they would probably get along.
Both have red hair.
Similar so, energy.
Yeah. I think he would probably still be upset, would be my guess, because MJ belongs with Peter in his opinion, and that's it. This is from Edward Doherty. If you could choose one comic or series to have just the dialogue rewritten without changing anything else, what would it be?
Ooh, sort of a burn, writer burn.
Choose one comic or series to have just the dialogue rerun.
And just the dialogue is an interesting call. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind recently is the issue of the Captain America crossover that's been happening, where Steve Rogers and Sam Wilson have a fight that is dumb.
Yeah.
And if we could just change a lot of the things, the reasons why and what was said, I think would be better.
Back in the day at Marvel, they had a month of Nuff Said issues that were all silent. They should redo the dialogue on those.
Add some. You want to have be
add a bunch of words.
We're going to do like a micro oral history.
Yes.
On top of those issues.
Let's see if there's anything else. This is a controversial one. Mike Cancel says, why does each new MCU show get progressively worse? What do you think about that? Do you agree with that, Justin?
Tough. I don't know if they're getting progressively worse. I think they're just, they've plateaued in a very intense way to me. And I think it's because they're using sort of a broken model to make these shows, and there's not enough time or creative juice, or I guess time to allow more creative storytelling to happen. And the weird thing also is that for production reasons and COVID reasons, WandaVision went first, and that just happened to be the one with the biggest creative swings and weirdest choices out of the gate. So it was a sort of chance that that happened. We probably would have been watching Falcon and Winter Soldier first and been disappointed early.
There you go.
In a non-COVID world.
Yeah. Let's see. Just to wrap up here, this is from Kevin. If you could answer any question as Pete, what would it be? And answer as Pete.
I know what the answer would be. I mean, there any question could fit in. It would be just like, fuck you.
Yeah, yeah. Or my it's worth it for Pete, the art alone.
My friend Pete yelling. I mean, no one in my life, even like my most mortal enemy, has ever said harsher words to me than my good friend Pete LePage.
There you go. I think we've answered it. Excuse me. All right. I guess that's it for your audience questions. Now, since Pete isn't here, we are going to skip trivia.
Yeah, and we couldn't. I started looking through the obituaries, and it was just too dark to come up with somebody who died to really highlight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, anything.
That's how he does it.
Any deaths in particular you want to call out from the past couple of years? Justin.
That's what I'm saying. It's Pete's our mortician.
I do want to say before we wrap up the show here, we do have a sponsor for this week's episode. Here on Comic Book Club, we love comics and we love kids. So, of course, we love the podcast, Comics with My Kids. Here's the story. Yeah. A comic book loving dad wanted to share his love and passion for reading comics with his two kids. So Matt decided to introduce the kiddos to comics and podcasting. Now each week, Matt with Logan or Melody will read a family-friendly comic, collected edition, or graphic novel to share with fellow listeners and help spread the joy of reading comics. There are also creator interviews that spotlight their work, and they're starting up a summer reading campaign where they will post a reading list for future episodes so listeners both young and old can email in or give an audio clip with their opinions on the books. You can check out Comics with My Kids on comiccornerbox.blogspot.com for episodes and written reviews for the whole family, on Facebook at Comics with My Kids, on Twitter at Comics with My Kids, and of course, you can hear the podcast on Spotify, Apple, Google, Amazon, and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Beautiful. That sounds like an absolute blast.
Yes. Speaking of absolute blast, there is a blast of new comics coming out this week. So, Justin, what are you looking forward to?
Great question, Alex. And you know what? The first thing that I've been saying many times, I think every issue this comic has come out is, well, first Blue Book number 5, closing up the series, which has been really fun. Very much looking forward to that. But the real one I want to highlight is The Seasons Have Teeth number 3.
Yeah.
Man, written by Dan Waters. I, from Boom, like, this book is crushing it. It's about a world that's not post-apocalyptic, I guess, where the seasons have become sort of giant monsters. Not necessarily kaiju, but sort of like more mystical versions of that. And this photographer is trying to take pictures of them all, chasing them down over the course of these first 3 issues, and having this like self meditation about the choices in his life. And it is so good. One of my favorite reads.
I'm very curious about The Oddly Pedestrian Life of Christopher Chaos, number 1 from Dark Horse Comics. This comes from an idea from James Tynion IV, and it's written by Tate Bromble, who's been collaborating with a lot of hype on this book, so curious to check that out. And I'll also give a shout out to The Riddler Year 1 from Paul Dano and Stephen Subic.
Interesting.
I just am really into this book. It's a spinoff of The Batman, but it is punching above his weight. Is that the expression? Whatever it is.
You could say that in a boxing sense.
Sure.
I will say I have enjoyed this series. This issue specifically, I was like, maybe.
Yes, I was looking forward to this, is what I say. And we'll talk more about all of these books on the Stack podcast. Yes.
Real quick, Derek Mainhart in the comments, The Neighbors 4, also another, like, that book is scary.
Yes, very upsetting and scary. We're going to be talking about that as well on our Stack podcast that comes out Wednesday, 9 a.m. in the Comic Book Club feed and its dedicated Stack feed. And folks, that is it for this week's show. A couple of people we want to thank. We want to thank Ayuze Jama Everett for coming on to talk about The Last Count of Monte Cristo, Ed Gross for talking about Voices from Krypton, and Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez for talking about La Borinquena, Volume 1 on Zoop.
Great.
Next week, we don't have a show. It's July 4th. We're not going to do
it. 4th of July. Fourth of July. Fireworks.
Yeah.
Make a mess.
I assume we will probably still do a stack podcast, but there will be no live podcast. However, we will be back on July 11th with Shane Berryhill to talk about Comic Books Kill, and Megan Bowman and Rachel Briner to talk about Dear Rosie. We have a bunch of other podcasts that are running in the meantime. Sons of a Gun, yeah. Our DC podcast, is coming out weekly. Marvel Vision, our Marvel podcast, also coming out weekly. Recap and Secret Invasion right now. Riverdale After Dark, our Riverdale podcast, also coming out weekly after episodes of that show air. Patreon.com/comicbookclub. Support this show and all the shows we do. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, Stitcher, or the app of your choice. At Comic Book Live on Twitter. Comic Book Club Live on TikTok and Instagram. ComicBookClubLive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, good night.
Good night, everybody. Your friend Taylor.